From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Last night was contentious. No handshaking before or after the debate. What will happen tonight when Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton sit down together at the annual white tie fundraiser for Catholic Charities in New York, known as the Al Smith Dinner? Traditionally, it's the last time presidential candidates share a stage before the election, and one in which they also share jokes. But today, nobody is laughing.
Trump is tweeting, though. He tweeted that Hillary Clinton got the debate questions in advance. She tweeted, "He can't handle reality." After this moment in last night's debate, when moderator Chris Wallace pressed Trump about the tradition of candidates accepting the results on election night.
The loser concedes to the winner, not saying that you're necessarily going to be the loser or the winner, but that the loser concedes to the winner and that the country comes together in part for the good of the country. Are you saying you're not prepared now to commit to that principle?
What I'm saying is that I will tell you at the time. I'll keep you in suspense.
Well, joining us from Washington, Here Now political commentators Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist, not working for the Clinton campaign. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. And Paris Denard, Republican strategist, not working for the Trump campaign. Hi, Paris.
Hello, hello, hello.
And we have to start with you, Paris. Was that a mistake on Trump's part to refuse to say that he would accept the results on election night?
You know, the unfortunate thing about this election is that people continue to ask Mr. Trump to ask Mr. Trump this question. During the GOP primary, the RNC actually created a document for him to sign, forcing him to say that he was going to support the nominee. And then they forced all the rest of the candidates to do the same. And most of them reneged on that contract, with the exception of people like Governor Christie and Ben Carson and Governor Perry. But at the end of the day, we continue to ask Mr. Trump, what is he going to do? Are you going to concede? And look, he doesn't have to answer the question. It wasn't a mistake. And there's precedent. If you look back on in 2000 with Gore v. Bush, if he would have come right out and just conceded, it would have been a mistake. And so you got to wait to see what's going to happen, because
okay,
he believes that there's a rigged election.
Jamal, jump in.
Well, I think as someone who is a veteran of the Gore v. Bush fight, who spent several weeks in West Palm Beach and also was at the vice president's residence the night that he conceded, there was never a doubt that once the results were in, that the vice president was going to concede to Bush, if that was the final result. With Donald Trump, the problem is we're just not sure what he will do. And what we can all hope, though, is that people with saner heads like Mike Pence and Ivanka Trump and Kellyanne Conway will concede to the person who wins the election and make sure that many of their folks know that it's time for us to move on.
And Paris, this seemed to be the talking point afterwards when everybody came forward and said Al Gore. But that was a unique situation when there was a mandatory recount of votes in Florida, which is, of course, why he couldn't concede. It wasn't over.
That was also after the election rather than before.
And do you understand that, you know, that there are so many people, Republicans among them today, asking, what kind of a message does that send? We are supposed to be the country. We're not a third world country. We're a country where you accept the part of the democracy that's the election.
What kind of country is it when we continue to ask one person what he's going to do if he loses?
Well, he's the
only
one.
Assuming that he will.
And
we don't do this to Secretary Clinton. We didn't do that to the rest of the GOP nominees that were running. We continue to do that to him, and it's unfair. We need to accept the fact,
because he's indicated that he thinks the election is rigged. He's the only one who said that.
There's evidence that it is rigged.
Oh, come on. That's not really true. Here's the real
problem. The videotape that he talked about last night was proof positive, and you look at some of the voting discrepancies. You asked Richard Nixon.
Richard Nixon had the same problem. You know what Richard Nixon did? He conceded the election. He didn't fight it out in Texas
and
in Chicago.
He would have been president.
Well, let's get to a bigger issue here.
Well, let's go to another moment.
That Trump is not the problem with Mr. Trump is that he has not proved himself to be a patriot when it comes to the very foundational things about our democracy. He challenges the freedom of the press. He's challenging the electoral system. He challenges all the things that we sort of hold dear about how we function as a society. And what we need to see from him and hear from him is that he is willing to subsume his own personal desires for what's best for the country. Well, that's all anybody really wants.
Well, let's ask a question about your candidate, Jamal, or your party's candidate. First of all, did she miss opportunities? At one point, Donald Trump said repeatedly that it was President Obama who deported so many immigrants. Doesn't that undercut his argument that she and Obama are softer on immigrants? But she didn't say anything. Did she miss some opportunities?
I think Hillary Clinton's objective last night was to walk out there and be president of the United States. Show people what it looks like when you have somebody who is responsible and dealing with the issues at hand in a responsible way. You know, she put some shots to Mr. Trump. I think she baited him, and he took the bait, and she reeled him in. And by the time it was over, he could barely contain himself, and it just made the contrast between the two of them so much starker.
Wouldn't it have been more presidential, though, to shake hands? They didn't shake hands before or after. I mean, you could put that on both of the candidates, but what do you think, Jamal, about Hillary Clinton on that front? Should she have gone over and shaken his hand?
I think we've reached a level of depth in this contest where we're going after each other. The two candidates are going after each other in ways that really most people would understand why she wouldn't want to shake his hand.
She was Secretary of State. She's been a First Lady and a United States Senator. She knows decorum. She knows political savviness, and she knows what is diplomatic. She should have shaken Mr. Trump's hand.
What about this moment when Clinton was talking about paying more into the Social Security Trust Fund through increased taxes, and she took a dig at Donald Trump for not paying his federal income taxes? Here it is.
My Social Security payroll contribution will go up, as will Donald's, assuming he can't figure out how to get out of it. But what we want to do is to replenish the Social Security Trust Fund by making sure.
Jamal, what do you think about that moment? A lot of people have said today that really is a turnoff for women voters in particular.
Speaking on behalf of women voters,
I'm here. I'm sitting here.
Right.
Go ahead.
But what I will say, here's the challenge from a strategist perspective. Donald Trump is doing very badly with women and not doing as well as he should do, particularly with white women who are part of the Republican coalition in order to win. I don't see moments like that making him, endearing him to that population and gaining him any votes.
But pushback to that was his line on partial birth abortion, which I think was a very strong one, very appropriate, and it put Secretary Clinton in the hot seat about an issue that she did not want to talk about at all. And Mr. Trump was very strong in that. And I think a lot of women, independent women, thought about this situation thinking, you know what, I might be pro-choice, I might want to support abortion, but partial birth abortion, that's something I cannot agree with. And I think he made Secretary Clinton very uncomfortable.
Well, and Jamal, weigh in on that, because some people are saying that actually she really went out and maybe got a lot of the more to the left Bernie Sanders voters who wanted to hear her say something strong like, I know women who have had to make this choice and it should only be made by the woman.
Yes. And, you know, Cecile Richards from Planned Parenthood tweeted out last night that she had had an abortion and that this was – and when Donald Trump is talking about women, he's talking about women like her. I think that this is something that women who have had to make this decision and found it to be very personal, and people who've known people who've had to go through it, like, it's not something they want to see batted about in a political discourse. This is something for people to deal with their doctors and their families and themselves in however way they feel is appropriate. And I think the problem here fundamentally is that Donald Trump just does not seem like he is operating from a perspective where he's putting their needs ahead of his. And in the ways we saw him on the bus with Billy Bush, to the ways he's talked about people like Alicia Machado, he does not seem to be putting the feelings and concerns of other people ahead of his own desires.
Mm-hmm. Paris, 2.5 weeks left until Election Day, voting already underway in some places. What does Donald Trump need to do as a closing argument in this campaign? And what about Republicans in Congress as well, some of whom are very worried about what might happen to them?
Yeah, I think the Republicans in Congress need to focus on their race. There's some that are going to be safe. There are strong Republican districts. The other ones need to focus on what they're going to do and tie this election back to Barack Obama and to Secretary Clinton and the problems that many of the communities are having. What Mr. Trump needs to do specifically is to stay on message as it relates to the 30 years that Secretary Clinton has been in office. And he started that last night. He said, if you've been in office for 30 years, what have you done? It's like Janet Jackson. Great. Congratulations. But what have you done for me lately? What have you done for the community, for the Black community, Latino community? For our everyday Americans, what have you done lately? And really, that's the question that American people are going to ask. And what has President Obama done when you look at the state of the country now? And do you want 4 more years of that? So that line of defense, 30 years of doing nothing, I've been a successful business, and that's going to do for America.
Well, of course, that opened up her line of attack of quoting everything he did for the past 30 years, hosting TV shows. Well, you know, while she
was successful.
Yeah. Well, but he did
while she was doing things that were fighting for other people, he was doing things to enrich himself. I think that's the fundamental contrast between these two candidates.
Well, but, you know, Paris, I really want to ask you, I sincerely do. We have had long conversations through the conventions and elsewhere. Donald Trump had very strong moments. Everybody kind of agrees that the first 30, 40 minutes, very strong, very on point. He had rehearsed. He had, you know, it right. showed. He talked about trade. He talked right. about things in a very statesmanlike way. Then something happened. Now, either it was, as Jeremy said, he takes the bait. Something happens, and it seems to be that way in every one of the debates. Do you worry about a presidential candidate who, for whatever the reason, can't hold it together, or has the appearance of not being able to hold it together?
I think what happens each time in these debates, what you see is that Mr. Trump tries to stay on policy and tries to talk about things of substance, and Secretary Clinton takes the low road and starts to dig in about
But that's what world leaders will do. You know?
No, I don't know. I don't think world leaders will do that. I think there's a thing. There's something that she does that is really, in her words, deplorable. And
she
Mr. Trump,
him, she called him a choker and a puppet, and he lost his.
And you think
mind.
That's presidential, and you think that's diplomatic? Nobody, no world leader goes on stage, calls people choker and things like that. So
no,
what he does
do
is respond. He responded to that. Mr. Trump is someone who is unconventional. He's not the same
okay.
type of candidate. He's not polished, but he's going to defend himself. We'll
Eric,
see in November.
Paris Denard, Republican strategist, and Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist, neither working with the campaigns.
And don't sit them together at dinner.
He's the puppet.
Thanks so much.
Drought conditions from abnormal to extreme continue to persist in California and the Southeast. The northeastern U.S. is also in a drought, the worst in more than a decade. Groundwater reserves are depleted in wells across the region. Farmers are trucking in water for their livestock. Homeowners have been forced to dig new wells, and towns are trying to find ways to conserve this now limited resource. Julia Botero, with Here and Now contributor North Country Public Radio, reports from upstate New York.
This year's dry summer first put a dent in the hay crop. Then it made cornfields turn from lush green to golden brown. Now, after 6 months of little rain, wells around the region are drying up. An old-fashioned drill rig pounds into granite bedrock outside a home in the town of Canton in northern New York. Richard Collins says his rig is drilling about a foot and a half an hour, searching for water. He says it'll likely have to drill down at least 140 feet before he finds it. Collins' well drilling business is a one-man operation, and he says he's been really busy.
This year, I can't drill fast enough. I'm turning work away. I mean, there's so much of it out there.
Collins was asked by Roger Bailey to drill this well outside his home when the water in his old well ran low.
Well, I saw what my wife Bobby had to do to carry water that we could drink, or we're going out to take showers in other people's houses. We're not living life the same way.
60 miles southwest, the New York village Copenhagen, population 800, is living off water from just one well. The other two dried up weeks ago. Village Mayor Scott Alexander says water in the well was trucked in from two nearby towns. And for now, the village is holding its own.
As long as everybody does their part to continue to conserve as much as possible, we will be okay.
Conservation measures, like canceling the town's annual turkey dinner for the first time in 75 years, and making other changes in how things are done. At Copenhagen Central School, Superintendent Scott Connell leads me into the school's cafeteria. It's pizza day.
So yeah, it looks like this is the end of middle school lunch.
Students are seated together at round tables eating their slices off paper plates. In the food line, students choose between paper bowls filled with corn, carrots, and peas.
So if you can look in the garbage can, most of that normally would be going through the dishwasher, but now it's going in the garbage can because it's paper.
Connell says the school is throwing out extra bags of garbage, but that's not a big concern right now.
We're saving close to 1,000 gallons a day by doing what we're doing, so there's not a lot more we can do. I mean, we have to flush toilets. We have to allow kids to wash their hands.
According to national drought numbers, northern and western New York has gotten around 11 inches of rain since March. That's little enough for the U.S. Department of Agriculture to list a third of the 62 counties in the state as disaster areas. That means farmers there can get federal aid. But some agriculture leaders in the northern part of the state say a few farms in the area are worse off and they need more. At Lucky Seven Livestock Farm in Rodman, Steve Winkler shows me a 300-gallon jug on the bed of a pickup truck. He's been filling this up from his neighbor's well two, sometimes three times a day for his hundreds of pigs.
I mean, I'm living and breathing this stress every day, and I know there's guys worse shape than I am, hauling bigger than me, hauling more water.
Some farms have drilled new wells on their lands. Others are dealing with much lower yield of corn than last year. Winkler has hired a contractor to search for more surface water on his land.
I hope it doesn't go into January, February when we have, some days -5 and a 40-mile-an-hour wind. That valve is going to freeze, and then we got to heat it, and so it'll magnify the stress level here.
More rain is in the forecast for the region as the weather cools. Still, it's going to require a lot of rain to fill up the region's wells again. For Here and Now, I'm Julia Botero.
Well, joining us now in the studio is our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, who has some ideas about chicken. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Jeremy.
Chicken.
Chicken.
It's what's for dinner, maybe, a lot of the time for a lot of people. But why chicken?
Yeah, it is what's for dinner for a lot of people. It seems to be the go-to dinner for families that are rushing, for people that are rushing. Apparently, according to the USDA, in 2013, the average American ate 57.7 pounds of chicken per person compared to 53 pounds of beef and 43 pounds of pork. So it has been extremely popular for quite a while now. You ask yourself why. Part of it is that there are so many different cuts, and in most grocery stores, they're already cut up for you, so it's a quick dinner. You can get a homemade chicken dinner on the table in about 30, 45 minutes. That's pretty great.
And there are so many things you can do with it.
It is wildly versatile, and it doesn't feel like, you know, sometimes if you buy a rib of beef or something, that's like a dinner party. But a chicken, to me, I have to say, when I'm feeling kind of glum, which never happens, but, you know, if it were to happen, I would roast a chicken because that is my absolute most comfort. Makes me feel like all is right with the world. And I have to also say that roasting a chicken is hard to screw up. However, there are several tips I could give you.
Such as?
Well, here's what I do, at least. I always stick a lemon in the cavity. And what it does is doesn't turn it into lemon chicken, but it flavors from the inside out. Just cut a little X in it so it doesn't explode. Put it in the cavity. I also like to take some butter or even olive oil with chopped garlic and herbs, and I tuck it in between the breast meat and the skin. There's a little pocket there, and you just push it in. And what that does is it kind of bastes the chicken as it roasts. I love to make a roast chicken very hot. I'll start it out at about 450, and then after about 20, 30 minutes when it's really crispy and brown, I bring it down to 325. But roast chicken is just the beginning. As you can see, the dishes in front of you.
And let's talk about one of them. This is a beautiful chicken with lemon and olives.
Lemon, olives, and capers. So this is primarily chicken thighs. You can buy boneless chicken thighs, cut them in half, or you can use any part of the chicken that you like. When I was a kid, I always had chicken breast. It was just like what I did. But now I find chicken thighs are so much juicier and they stay moist for much longer. So what I did was I browned the chicken, coated in a tiny bit of flour, browned it, put it in that in an oven-proof skillet or a gratin dish, then threw some white wine, capers, lemon, and olives in the pan, threw it on top, and roasted it.
It's like a piccata.
It is a version of a piccata, which is one of my absolute favorites.
You also have here a chicken salad sandwich.
Yeah, I never bring you sandwiches, but I love a good sandwich, and what a perfect midday meal. I've been making a lot of soup, and I make a lot of chicken stock, so you have this whole chicken left over after you make stock. And what do you do with it? So I make chicken salad. So that is fresh chicken meat that it was cooked to make a stock with good crunchy bread, as you'll hear. And I tossed it with fresh lemon juice, a lot of fresh herbs, and chopped up homemade pickles. You could use any type of pickle, a dill, sour, bread and butter pickles. And then I put arugula, and it's on a ciabatta or a crusty piece of bread. And when I was a little girl, there was a place in New York City called Mary Elizabeth. It was a tea room for ladies. And my grandmother used to take me there, and they made a chicken salad sandwich that I never forgot.
You know, one of my favorite things to have that involves chicken is a chicken parm.
Love it.
And I know that you have an interesting recipe.
I do. So this came from my friend Ronnie Maddalena. You double dip it. You whip some eggs in a bowl, and then in another bowl you have panko or good breadcrumbs. You take the chicken pieces, you dip it in the eggs, and then in the seasoned breadcrumbs, then back into the eggs, then back into the breadcrumbs. And what happens is that you develop this gorgeous crust. You saute them, and then you put them in a pan on top of some tomato sauce and bake them with some grated Parmesan cheese. To die for!
You know, by the way, I think we've talked about this before, but one of my favorite things to eat of all time, although I have it maybe once a year, is a coq au vin.
You've talked about this. You said that your mother made it for you, and that you I love it too. It's kind of another more sophisticated comfort. It's a chicken stew, of course, with red wine and mushrooms and pearl onions. It's such a delicious dish.
As a person, Kathy, who has traveled and sampled a lot of different foods and made a lot of them, do you think, as they say, everything kind of tastes like chicken?
That's so funny because I love when people say that. I don't. I mean, there's a certain texture to chicken. You know, I remember the first time somebody actually served me frog's legs and I was so horrified. And the way that people get you to eat things is they say, go on, try it. It tastes like chicken.
Yeah. And did it?
I don't even want to talk about it. Not my favorite. Although if there's enough garlic, I'll eat anything.
I can tell you this right now. There is no way we're going to be doing a segment with Kathy about frog's legs.
Good
I know
point.
It right now.
I think you've hit the nail on the head, as they say.
Kathy Gunst, our resident chef, and we'll link you to the recipes for some of these chicken dishes at hereandnow.org. By the way, Kathy's got a new book out as well. It's called Soup Swap, Comforting Recipes to Make and Share. Kathy, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Two balls, two strikes. Here it comes. In the air. Foul territory. The Cleveland Indians are going to the World Series.
That sound from last night, the Indians shut out the Blue Jays 3-0 in Toronto to win the American League pennant. They'll be in the World Series for the first time since 1997. The last time Cleveland won the championship was in 1948. The National League pennant is still up for grabs. The series between the Chicago Cubs and the Los Angeles Dodgers tied 2-2 with Game 5 happening tonight. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com, and he joins us today from Las Vegas. Mike, what a huge moment for Cleveland. The Cavaliers just won the NBA title a few months ago. Now the Indians going to the World Series.
Yes. And, you know, the Cavs are a great team, and they were never, though, the heart and soul of Cleveland. I mean, the Browns and the Indians were Major League. That movie was about how terrible the Indians are. And you know when you have a wish fulfillment movie, the team that they cast to fulfill the wish, sometimes it's the Cubs, sometimes it's the Indians. It would be great if we got that World Series. And I would like to say the thing I especially like about the Cleveland Indians is they have really one great pitcher and then a bunch of players who platoon at individual positions. So not a great player per se in left field or center field or right field, but against the righty or against the lefty, watch out for those bats. They're a really well-managed team. I like them.
Okay, and we'll have to see what happens in the World Series. But if you're in Cleveland, you're also looking forward to the start of the NBA season and whether maybe the Cavaliers could end up once again going up against Golden State at the end of the season.
Well, that is, and I'll tell you because I'm in Vegas, those are the odds-on favorites. And, of course, the Cavaliers with LeBron James pulling the huge upset against the Warriors. Now, the fact that it was an upset means that the Warriors were the best team in basketball, and they did set the record for regular season wins. And they added, I don't know, the second-best, third-best player in basketball in Kevin Durant. So I would say that I have never been looking forward to the improvement of an already excellent team more than I am looking to see what the Warriors do, how they incorporate Durant. Because a lot of times when you add a great player, it's in a position where it's clearly defined or maybe to address a deficiency. This is not addressing a deficiency. This is sort of changing an ecosystem. And so we'll have to see how the rest of the fauna reacts to the new addition.
What other teams do you have your eye on in the NBA this year?
You know, I have to say those two teams are so likely to make the finals, but right under them in the West, you can't count out the Spurs. And the most interesting team in basketball, I think, is the Celtics, because if it wasn't for the Durant signing, we would say that Al Horford, signed by the Celtics in the offseason, was the biggest addition. And they are another extremely well-coached team. That should be the Eastern Conference Finals. I don't know if Cleveland will have trouble with them. Here we are forecasting 5-6 months down the road, but the Celtics are intriguing.
What about other players to watch this season?
Well, you know, we're talking about the Warriors and Durant, but let's not forget that David West also signed, and he's this Swiss Army knife of a player, and there are a bunch of players who took pretty much the league minimum just to get on that train. And then I would also look for, in Brooklyn, they could be the worst team in basketball, but I live three blocks from the arena, and Jeremy Lin, you know, there could be Lin Sanity in Brooklyn. Why
again,
not talk about
Lin
the worst
Sanity
team?
Again?
The revisiting of Lin Sanity. And by the way, of the 12 players on Brooklyn, I think 8 of them now live in the borough, and you see them around town. It's kind of like old Brooklyn Dodgers magic, except the Nets are going to be terrible.
That's Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome.
Today, Iraqi special forces joined regular troops in the battle for Mosul, launching a pre-dawn push on the nearby town held by ISIS. That's the focus right now, clearing the many villages that ring Mosul, Iraq's second largest city, which ISIS has held since 2014. The U.S. is supporting the offensive with airstrikes and special op troops on the ground as advisors. Shia militias and Kurdish Peshmerga fighters are also on the front lines. And with them today was CBS correspondent Holly Williams. She's returned now to nearby Erbil and joins us on Skype. And Holly, where were you with the Peshmerga? What did you see today?
We were on a ridge with them about 15 miles north of Mosul. We actually overnighted up there because we knew that they were starting, that they were launching a new attack this morning. And that kicked off around dawn. They told us that the plan was to recapture around 27 villages from ISIS north of Mosul and then move forward to about 5 miles from Mosul. But it was very slow going, which is something that we've seen over the last 4 days. So they were really pummeling the two villages that we could see with artillery. But ISIS was returning fire, both with light arms. They were mortaring some of the Peshmerga positions. And very interestingly, we saw two different ISIS drones from where we were. Now, we still don't know whether they were just surveillance drones or whether they were armed in some way, but certainly as soon as the Kurdish troops saw those drones, they opened fire. I mean, just a barrage of fire. And shot them down. And I think the fact that they're so jittery about those drones really isn't surprising because two Kurdish soldiers were killed earlier this month by an ISIS drone that was loaded with explosives.
Yeah. So, I mean, there you are watching this firefight between the Peshmerga fighters and ISIS fighters in the village. And we're hearing that these villages have to be taken first, step by step, to get to Mosul. You were in one of them, Kabali. After ISIS fled that village, after the offensive started on Monday, and they'd left many of the homes rigged with homemade bombs. You spoke to a man who returned to his after being gone for 2 years to find it booby-trapped. Let's listen.
Why would ISIS put explosives in your house? They're our enemies, he told us, and they have no mercy.
So, Holly, we're getting a sense of the difficulty here because it's not just clearing villages of ISIS, it's clearing them of what ISIS has left behind.
Right. And remember that nearly all of these villages that are being fought over at the moment were cleared of residents 2 years ago when ISIS blitzed across northern Iraq. And yet it's still really slow going. For a few reasons. I think firstly, because some ISIS extremists are willing to fight to the death. Some of them have run away. Some are willing to fight to the death. Remember, this is, you know, what many people call a death cult. ISIS is an organization that people join in many cases because they want to be, you know, a martyr to the cause. Mm-hmm. So that's who, you know, Kurdish forces and Iraqi forces are up against. And then secondly, as you just heard, in many of these villages, ISIS doesn't just flee. They leave behind these homemade bombs, homemade explosive devices, and they have to be cleared before those forces can then move on.
Well, the difference it would seem with Mosul, I mean, they might be booby-trapping Mosul as well, but there are civilians there. So what's the thinking about, you know, getting some of them out before the assault on Mosul?
Well, you know, the problem at the moment is that ISIS is preventing people from leaving. I mean, ISIS is effectively using those million or so residents. That's how many people we think are left in Mosul. ISIS is using them as human shields. Some people are making it out. You know, we've seen a trickle of people making it out and coming to refugee camps here. And, you know, let's see as this battle progresses in the next, you know, few weeks and perhaps months, it may be that we see hundreds of thousands, you know, by some predictions, even a million people pouring out of Mosul.
Yeah. And by the way, one of your colleagues, equally brave there on the front lines from CNN, talked on the very first day about suddenly seeing an ISIS fighter pop up on a ridge and yards from him have a firefight with the troops he was with. And then the ISIS fighter blew himself up. Have you seen ISIS?
We haven't. I mean, we can hear them firing at the Peshmerga positions, but that's a really interesting question. And we were actually discussing it today. We were saying it's so weird that you know, we're here reporting on this offensive against ISIS, and yet, you know, we can't see the enemy. Mm-hmm. That said, ISIS has, you know, it's an organization that's well known for its kind of slickly produced propaganda videos, and it's put some of those out in the last few days. You know, it put out one video from Mosul claiming to show that life there was kind of going on pretty much as normal, street scenes, people on the street, market stalls, that kind of thing. It also showed, you know, ISIS extremists fighting back against the offensive. But one of those videos was yet another barbaric execution video, a man that ISIS accused of being a spy. And I think that's a, you know, it's a reminder of what constitutes normal life under ISIS.
Now, we've seen that video. Thankfully, it stops right before he's shot to death. Holly, you're one of a handful of correspondents covering this from the front lines. Clarissa Ward from CNN, Mike Giglio of BuzzFeed, Orla Guerin of the BBC, to name a few of the few. You have our tremendous admiration. And I hope this isn't sort of a bothersome question while you're doing such important work there. But last night we had the presidential debates here in the U.S. And the Republican candidate, Donald Trump, first of all, criticized once again the idea that people are telegraphing that the attack on Mosul is coming. You've made it pretty clear that in order to get to Mosul, they're going to have to take villages before Mosul. And so it's not as if there could be a secret assault on Mosul. But he also implied that there's some sort of wag the dog to this, that this was done to support Hillary Clinton's candidacy, to have this show of force in Iraq. Do you get any sense of that there?
You know, it's difficult for me to speak to that about how the decision regarding timing was made. But I would say that you know, I suppose you could argue that if the Mosul offensive is over very quickly, then that might benefit Hillary Clinton politically. On the other hand, this fight could go on for months, and it could go very badly wrong for the Iraqi forces, which presumably, you know, would not be of much benefit to Hillary Clinton. So, you know, let's see how this plays out.
Well, and you, as you said, it could go on for months. What do you do? You know, I'm assuming you want to keep this on the radar, but we are hearing it will be house-to-house combat, searching for explosives and booby traps for months.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I'll be coming in and out of Iraq over the next few weeks, months, let's see. But I think, you know, the thing is, we don't know how long this is going to take because there are so many variables. I mean, one is, you know, the U.S. military says that it has retrained the Iraqi military over the last 2 years. The same force the same force that sort of turned tail and ran when ISIS first blitzed across northern Iraq 2 years ago. The U.S. military says it is a new army and it's ready to fight. Is that true? You know, we don't know yet. Then there's ISIS. You know, what are they going to do? The U.S. military thinks there are fewer than 5,000 fighters left. They say that some of them are already fleeing and heading across the border into Syria towards Raqqa and other ISIS stronghold. How many of them will do that? How many of them will stay and fight to the death? You know, we just don't know. And then the people of Mosul. Remember that 2 years ago, when ISIS seized the city with probably just a few hundred fighters, a lot of the people in Mosul welcomed them, cheered them on the street, celebrated, because Mosul is a majority Sunni Muslim city, and many of its residents were just fed up with the government in Baghdad, which is Shiite dominated, and they saw ISIS as as revolutionaries, as heroes, as their saviors, and they welcome them. How much has that changed? Are the people in Mosul ready to rise up against ISIS? And probably part of the answer to that question depends on who comes into the city to, you know, to liberate them.
Of the Peshmerga fighters, the Iraqi fighters, the Turks have wanted to get involved. Yeah, so we don't know endgame there. CBS correspondent Hallie Williams speaking to us from Erbil. She's just returned from the front lines there outside Mosul. Hallie, thank you and be safe.
Thank you.
At a rally today in Ohio, Donald Trump said he would accept the result of the election if he wins, following up on what he said last night, that he wouldn't commit to accepting the results of the election. Many saw that as at odds with the values of our democracy and unprecedented historically in this country. Joining us now is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. Hi, Julian.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, great to have you. And what do you think of what Trump has been saying about not accepting, or I'll accept if I win, the results of the election?
I think the rhetoric's causing a lot of fear, understandably. One, because there are fears that on election day there'll be intimidation and harassment of voters as his supporters go to quote-unquote monitor whether there's fraud. And second, it creates doubts about the legitimacy of the outcome if Hillary Clinton wins. And many Republicans already have problems with any Democratic president, but many who listen to Trump might now think that this is not even a legitimate victory. So it creates a toxic governing environment.
What do you think of the argument from many Trump supporters that Al Gore contested the election in 2000? What's the difference?
I think these are two very different things. In 2000, there were questions about very specific votes in Florida, and a recount process began. It was at that point where Al Gore took back his concession speech and waited until the recount process took place and then conceded once the Supreme Court issued its decision. That's different than a month into the election basically making your campaign theme that the whole process is rigged without any evidence to prove it.
Julian, one of the elections people have compared this one to is the election of 1964 when Barry Goldwater ran against Lyndon Johnson. Here's Goldwater at the convention that year.
I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
And the Democratic candidate, Lyndon Johnson, who had assumed the presidency after the assassination of President Kennedy in 1963. Here he is.
I accept the duty of leading this party to victory this year.
And he did do that. It was no contest. Johnson won 61% of the vote. Goldwater just 38%. First of all, do you see any similarities between this election and that election?
Well, the big difference is Goldwater was someone who was ideologically very conservative, committed to a set of principles, and tried to push his party in a different direction, whereas there's little evidence that Trump has a coherent set of principles. He's running more on a certain style of politics and making certain arguments about the need for new leadership. Another difference is that today Trump could very well do better just because the electorate's more polarized. So many people might still vote Republican, including in their congressional races, even if they don't like him. Whereas in 64, there were people in states like Illinois who were willing to switch from red to blue because they didn't like the top of the ticket.
But in 64, after a landslide loss, what happened to the Republican Party?
The party moved in two directions. In the short term, for the next couple of years, no Republican wanted to look like Barry Goldwater. So most Republicans softened their position. They avoided being seen as too extreme. And they actually worked with Lyndon Johnson on programs like Medicare and expanding Social Security. The other path was long term. Ronald Reagan, who did a famous ad for Goldwater, set out to remake the party and to present Goldwater arguments with a more charismatic and in some ways softer tone. So that the party actually moved in two different directions.
So do you expect that something like that would happen if Donald Trump were to lose this year, that we might see in the next 4 years or maybe even after that somebody who kind of carries the same message that Trump is carrying but in a different style?
I think you will see that. This didn't come out of nowhere. There have been changes taking place in the Republican Party within many parts of the electorate that allowed for Trump to succeed, both in the primaries and to do what he's done in the general election, which is still substantial. So I don't think once you take Trump out, the party is going to ignore some of the arguments that he made and even some of his political style. I assume you'll hear more of it, but maybe a different style of presentation.
What about the Democrats back in 1964? What happened to them after that? Because they only held the White House for 4 years.
They did, and they enjoyed a great period in terms of legislative productivity. But in the middle of that victory, they started to make a series of pretty big mistakes, the biggest being Vietnam. And so they had many achievements in terms of domestic policy, like Medicare. But in some ways, being freed of the competition temporarily led them into poor policy choices.
That's Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School, talking with us about comparisons between this year's election and the election of 1964. We shall see, Julian, in just 2.5 weeks if there's any comparison to be made there. Thank you so much, as always.
Thanks for having me.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.